You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of the collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Inner Experiences of Evolution. This is Lecture 3, entitled The Inner Aspect of the Sun Embodiment of the Earth and the Transition to the Moon Embodiment. Given in Berlin, November 14th, 1911. In the last two lectures, I tried to point out that something spiritual lies behind all that is material in the phenomena in our universe. I tried to characterize the spiritual reality to be found behind the phenomena of warmth and streaming air. To describe such characteristics for you, I had to reach back into the most distant past of our evolutionary development. We also looked into our own soul life to describe the spiritual context that forms the basis of the material universe. After all, when we characterize something, we must take the ideas we use from somewhere else. Words alone are not enough. One must have very definite ideas. We have seen that the spiritual context, which we must refer to, lies far from anything human beings experience at the present time, far from what human beings today are able to know. Thus, to understand this context, we have to call upon conditions seldom found and contexts not generally understood in our own life of soul and spirit. We have seen that we have had to search for the deepest nature of the conditions of warmth and fire, far from the manifestation of outward physical fire or warmth. Certainly, when we identify sacrifice, indeed the sacrifice of specific beings, the thrones, whom we met during the ancient Saturn state of the Earth's development, and who at that time presented their sacrifice to the cherubim, as the essence of all conditions of fire and warmth in the cosmos, this must seem fantastic to a person today. And yet, to speak truly, we must say that, as it occurred at that point in the development of the cosmos, everything that appears to us outwardly, illusorily, in the condition of warmth or fire, actually consists of sacrifice. Similarly, we pointed out last time that behind everything that we call streaming air or gas lies something very distant, namely what we have called the virtue of bestowing, the devoted pouring forth of their own being by spiritual beings. That is what exists in every breath of wind, in every stream of air. What is perceived as outwardly physical is really only an illusion, Maya. Only when we have progressed from the illusion to the spiritual reality, will we have a correct idea. Fire or warmth or air are no more present as realities in the world than the human being is present in the image a person sees in a mirror. For as a mirror image is essentially an illusion in relation to the human being, so fire or warmth or air are illusions, and the truths behind them are the reality. Just as the real human being stands in relation to his or her image in the mirror. It is not fire or air that we seek in the realm of the true, but sacrifice and the virtue of bestowing. When we saw the virtue of bestowing added to sacrifice, we ascended from the ancient life of Saturn to that of the Sun. Within the second embodiment of our Earth, we find something that leads us a step nearer to the true circumstances of our development. And here we must once again introduce a concept that belongs to the realm of true reality as opposed to the world of illusion. That is, before we take up the actual circumstances of our evolutionary development, we must acquire a particular concept. Let us approach this concept as follows. When a human being in his or her outward life does something or accomplishes something, this generally results from his or her will impulse. Whatever a human being does, whether it is just a hand movement or a mighty deed, A will impulse stands behind the activity. Everything that leads a person to carry out a deed or to achieve something emanates from this. And it will probably be said that a strong, forceful deed, for example, one that brings healing and blessing, proceeds from a strong will impulse, and a less important act proceeds from a weaker impulse. In general, we are inclined to assume that the magnitude of the deed depends on the strength of the impulse of will. Only to a certain degree, however, is it correct to say that if we strengthen our will, we shall accomplish something significant in the world. Beyond a certain point, that is no longer the case. Surprisingly, certain deeds that a human being can carry out, above all deeds connected with the spiritual world, are not dependent upon the strengthening of our will impulse. Of course, in the physical world in which we live, the magnitude of the deed does depend on the strength of the will impulse. We have to make a greater effort if we want to accomplish more. But in the spiritual world, this is not the case. Rather, the opposite applies. To accomplish the greatest deeds, to achieve the greatest results in the spiritual world, a strengthening of the positive will impulse is not what is necessary. Rather, a certain resignation, a renunciation is needed. We can proceed on that assumption, even in the smallest, purely spiritual matters. We achieve a certain spiritual result, not by bringing our earnest desires into play, or being occupied with them, but by subduing our wishes, restraining our desires, and foregoing their satisfaction. Let us suppose that a person intended to accomplish something in the world through inner spiritual means. The individual has to prepare himself or herself by learning above all to suppress his or her wishes or desires. And while one becomes stronger in the physical world if one eats well and is well nourished and thus has more energy, one will achieve something significant in the spiritual world. This is a description, not advice. When one fasts or does something to suppress or renounce wishes and desires. Preparation that involves relinquishing the wishes, desires, and will impulses arising in us is always part of the greatest spiritual endeavors. The less we will, the more we can say that we let life stream over us and do not desire this or that, but rather take things as karma casts them before us. The more we accept karma and its consequences, the more we behave calmly, renouncing all that we otherwise would have wanted to achieve in life, the stronger we become. This is true, for example, in respect to the activity of thinking. In the instance of a teacher or educator who is filled with longings, and above all is fond of good food and drink, it will become evident that the words he or she directs at pupils do not accomplish very much. What the teacher says to the students goes right in one ear and out the other. Such a teacher will believe that the students are to blame for this, but that is not always the case. An educator who sees a higher meaning in life, lives in moderation, eats only as much as is necessary in order to sustain life, and above all accepts by choice the things that destiny bestows, will gradually notice that his or her words have great power. Even the glance of such a teacher can have a great effect. Indeed, it may not even be necessary for the teacher to look at a pupil. Such a teacher need only be near the student, need only have an encouraging thought. Even if the thought is not expressed verbally, it is nonetheless conveyed to the student. All of this depends upon the degree of renunciation and resignation a person exercises with regard to what is otherwise strongly desired. The path of renunciation is the right means of spiritual activity, and leads to spiritual results in higher worlds. In this respect, we can encounter many illusions, and even though an illusion of renunciation seems outwardly similar to true renunciation, illusions do not lead to the right results. You are all acquainted with what is called in ordinary life asceticism, self-inflicted suffering. In many cases, such self-torment can be self-indulgence, something a person chooses from a desire to accomplish something greater or out of some other source of desire for self-satisfaction. In such cases, self-denial is not effective, for self-denial has meaning only when it accompanies renunciation that is rooted in the spirit. We must understand the concept of creative renunciation, creative resignation. It is extremely important that we recognize renunciation or creative resignation, which we can actually experience in the soul, as an idea that is far removed from everyday life. Only then will we be able to take a step further in human evolution. For something like this occurred in the course of evolution, in the transition from the development of the sun condition to that of the moon condition. Something like resignation occurred then in the realm of the beings of the higher worlds, who, as we know, are linked to the course of the earth's development. To understand this, we shall need to consider the ancient sun development once again. But first, we will draw attention to something we already know, but which may have seemed puzzling in some respects up until now. We have pointed repeatedly to precedents in development that we can trace back to beings who remained behind in the course of development. We know, indeed, that luciferic beings intrude upon humankind on earth. And we have frequently pointed out that these luciferic beings, because they did not reach the stage of development that they could have achieved during the development of the ancient moon, are able to invade our astral body during earthly evolution. In this context, we have often used the trivial comparison that it is not only students who repeat a grade at school, but cosmic beings in the great course of cosmic evolution may also fail to complete a stage of development, and later interfere in the stages of development of other beings. Thus, luciferic beings who stayed behind during the ancient moon development interfere with human beings on the earth. Superficially, one could easily think that these beings must be flawed beings, weaklings in world evolution. Otherwise, why did they fail to achieve what they could have achieved? That thought could occur to us. But another thought we could also formulate is that human beings would never have come into their freedom, would never have developed an independent capacity to make decisions had luciferic beings not been held back on the moon. On the one hand, it is due to luciferic beings that we have desires, drives, and passions in our astral body that continually drive us from a certain height and pull us toward the lower regions of our being. On the other hand, however, were it not for our capacity to become evil and stray from the good through the power of the luciferic beings in our astral body, we could not act freely or have what we call free will or freedom of choice. It must be said, therefore, that we owe our freedom to the luciferic beings. The one-sided perspective that luciferic beings exist only to lead humanity astray is insufficient. Rather, we must regard the remaining behind of the luciferic beings as something good, as something without which we would not be able to achieve our worth as human beings in the true sense of the word. Yet something much deeper lies at the basis of what we call the remaining behind of the luciferic and Ahrimanic beings. We have already encountered it on ancient Saturn, but it is so difficult to recognize that we can hardly find words in any language to characterize it. Yet we can characterize it very clearly if we move forward to the reality of the ancient sun by taking into account the concept of resignation or renunciation we described today. For the basis of the remaining behind of beings and the influence stemming from it lies in resignation or renunciation on the part of higher beings. We can see, then, that the following occurred on the sun. We have said that the thrones, the spirits of will, offer sacrifice to the cherubim. They present this sacrifice, as we saw last time, not only during the Saturn era, they continue to do so during the sun era. The thrones, the spirits of will sacrificed to the cherubim in the sun era also. We saw too that the real essence of all that existed in the world as conditions of warmth or fire lies in this sacrifice. Now if we look back into the Akashic record, we can notice something else occurring during the sun period. The thrones sacrifice and maintain their activity of sacrifice. We see the sacrificing thrones. We also see a number of cherubim to whom the sacrifice ascends, receiving the warmth that flows from the sacrifice into themselves. But at the same time, a number of cherubim do something else. They renounce the sacrifice. They do not participate in it. Recognizing this, we complete the image that we allowed to enter our soul the last time. In this picture, we have the thrones who sacrifice and those cherubim who accept the sacrifice. And we also have the cherubim who do not accept the sacrifice, but give back what presses toward them as sacrifice. It is extraordinarily interesting to trace this in the Akashic Chronicle. For because the virtue of bestowing flows from the spirits of wisdom into the sacrificial warmth, we see how during the ancient sun, the smoke of sacrifice, which is reflected back in the form of light by the archangels from the outermost periphery of the sun, ascends. But we see something else as well. It is as if within the expanse of the ancient sun, something entirely different is also present, namely, sacrificial smoke that is neither reflected by the archangels as light, nor accepted by the cherubim, and therefore flows back, so that we have clouds of sacrifice in the sun expanse, sacrifice which ascends and sacrifice that descends, sacrifice that is accepted and sacrifice that is renounced and returned. We also find this self-encountering of the actual spiritual cloud image in the expansive ancient sun between what we called last time the outer and the inner. Let me read that sentence again. We also find this self-encountering of the actual spiritual cloud image in the expansive ancient sun between what we called last time the outer and the inner. We find it as a separate layer between these two dimensions on the sun. Thus, in the middle, we have the sacrificing thrones. In the heights, the cherubim who accept the sacrifice, and then those cherubim who do not accept the sacrifice, but divert it back again. Through this diverting back, a ring of clouds comes into being, and around this, we have the reflected mass of light. Imagine this picture in a living way. We have this ancient sun expanse, this ancient sun mass, like a cosmic globe, beyond which nothing is imaginable, so that we think of space extending only as far as the archangels. Imagine that at the center we have a ring formation made out of the meeting between the accepted and rejected sacrifices. Out of these accepted and returned sacrifices arises something in the ancient sun that we can call a division of the entire sun substance, a divergence. If we wish to compare the ancient sun to an outward image, we can compare it only to our present Saturn, a globe surrounded by a ring. The accumulating mass of the sacrifice is drawn inward into the center, and what remains outside is ordered into the form of a ring. Thus we have the sun substance divided into two parts, separated through the force of the arrested powers of sacrifice. What do the cherubim, who renounce the sacrifice, bring about? Here we approach an extraordinarily difficult subject. You will be able to grasp the concepts we will now consider only after a long process of meditation. Only after long reflection on the concepts to be given here will you discover the realities underlying them. The resignation we spoke of must be brought into relationship with the creation of time we learned occurred on ancient Saturn. We have seen that first time, We have seen that time first arose on ancient Saturn with the spirits of time, the Archai, and that it makes no sense to speak of time before ancient Saturn. Now a recapitulation occurs within this process, but even so, it is still possible to say that time continues from that point on. Continuation, duration, is a concept encompassed by the term time. When we say time is continuous, this means that when we investigate what is said about Saturn and Sun in the Akashic Chronicle, we discover that time is created during the Saturn epoch and is also present on the Sun. Now, if all conditions continue in the way we characterize them with regard to Saturn and the Sun in the last two lectures, then time would form an element in everything that happened in the course of evolution. We could not eliminate the element of time from any event in evolution. We have seen that the spirits of time were created on ancient Saturn, and that time is implanted in everything. And everything we have pictured or imagined about evolution since then must be conceived in the context of time. If what occurred consisted only of what we have presented, offering sacrifice and the virtue of bestowing, all of this would then have to be subject to time. Nothing would exist without being subject to time. Everything that comes into being and everything that passes away and therefore pertains to time, everything would be subject to time. Those cherubim who renounced the sacrifice, and at the same time what existed in the sacrificial smoke, renounced these things because they thereby deprived themselves of the properties of this sacrificial smoke. Now among the properties of the sacrificial smoke was, above all, time, and with it the process of coming into being and passing away. In the whole renunciation of the sacrifice, therefore, lies a capacity of the cherubim to grow beyond the conditions of time. These cherubim move beyond time. They are no longer subject to time. Thus the conditions of ancient Sun's development are divided, so that certain conditions, continuing in a direct line from Saturn as sacrifice and the virtue of bestowing, remain subject to time, whereas other conditions, under the direction of the cherubim who renounced the sacrifice, rest themselves out of time, so that eternity, permanence, not being subject to the processes of coming into being and passing away, may also exist. This is most remarkable. We come to the point in the development of the ancient Sun when time and eternity become separated. By means of the resignation of the cherubim during the Sun development, eternity came about as a consequence of certain conditions that occurred during that development. Just as, gazing into our own soul, we saw certain effects arising in the soul as the human being takes up renunciation and resignation, so we now see also eternity and immortality occur on ancient Sun, because certain divine spiritual beings have renounced sacrifice and the legacy of the virtue of bestowing. Just as we saw that time came into being on Saturn, so we see now that through certain circumstances, time was wrested out of the Sun phase of development. I have said, of course, please note this, that this was already being prepared during the Saturn epoch, so that eternity does not actually begin during the Sun period. But it is only in the Sun epoch that this can be seen clearly enough to express it in concepts. The separation of eternity from time is so barely perceptible on Saturn that our concepts and words are not precise enough to characterize how something like this existed for ancient Saturn and its development. We have now become acquainted with the meaning both of resignation, the renunciation of the gods during the time of the ancient Sun, and of the achievement of immortality. What were the further consequences of this? From title An Outline of Occult Science, through the description, although the description remains in a certain respect veiled in Maya, we know that the moon period of development followed the sun period, that at the end of the sun period all existing conditions were immersed in a kind of twilight, a cosmic chaos, and that these then emerged again as moon. We can see the emergence of sacrifice as warmth again. But what remains as warmth on the sun emerges on the moon as heat. What was previously the virtue of bestowing reappears as gas or air. Resignation, the renunciation of the sacrifice, also continues. What we called resignation is present in everything that occurs on the ancient moon. This is really so. What we were able to experience as resignation on the sun, we must also think of as a force in all that exists on ancient moon, having come over from the sun, and as something different from what we think of as existing in the external world. What existed as sacrifice appears in Maya as warmth. What was the virtue of bestowing appears as a gas or air. What existed as resignation appears as liquid or as water. Outwardly, water is Maya, and it would not exist in the world were it not for its spiritual foundation in renunciation or resignation. Wherever there is water in the world, there is divine renunciation. Just as warmth is an illusion, and behind it exists sacrifice, just as gas or air is an illusion behind which stands the virtue of bestowing, so water as substance, as external reality, is only a material illusion, a reflection of what truly exists, the resignation by certain beings of what they could have received from other beings. One could say it is only possible for water to flow in the world when resignation underlies the phenomenon. Now, we know that during the transition from the sun to the moon, conditions of air densified into conditions of water. Water first came into being on the moon. During the sun period, there was no water. What we saw during the ancient sun development in the gathering mass of clouds became water as it pressed together and emerged as the moon's ocean during the moon period. When we take this into account, it is possible to understand a question that can now be raised. Water arises out of resignation. In fact, water actually is resignation. Thus, we acquire a very unusual type of spiritual concept for what water really is. But we can also ask the question, is there not a difference between the condition that would have arisen had the cherubim not accomplished this resignation, and the condition that arose when they deprived themselves of what was offered? Isn't this difference expressed in some way? Yes, it is expressed. It is expressed by the fact that the consequences of that resignation arose during the moon conditions. If this resignation had not occurred, if the renouncing cherubim had accepted the sacrifice brought to them, they would have had, pictorially speaking, the sacrificial smoke within their own substance. Acceptance of the sacrifice would have been expressed in the sacrificial smoke. Let us assume these cherubim would have carried out this or that action. Then that action would appear expressed outwardly through self-transforming clouds of air. What the cherubim would have done by accepting the sacrificial substance would have been expressed in the outward form of air. But they rejected the substance of sacrifice, and thereby withdrew from mortality and entered immortality, withdrew from the transitory and entered the enduring. The substance of the sacrifice is still there, but is, so to speak, released from the forces that would otherwise have absorbed it. The sacrificial substance no longer needs to follow the inclinations and impulses of the cherubim, for these cherubim have released it, have turned it back. What happens then with this substance of sacrifice? Other beings are able to become independent. These beings are found near the cherubim, and would have been under their direction if the latter had accepted the substance of sacrifice. But the substance is no longer within these cherubim, and is independent of them. Because of this, the possibility arises for the opposite of resignation to occur. Other beings draw the poured-out substance of sacrifice to themselves and become active within it. These are the beings who remained behind. And so the presence of beings who stayed behind is a consequence of the cherubim's act of renunciation. The cherubim themselves produced the beings who stayed behind. Thus they created the possibility of remaining behind. Through the cherubim's rejection of a sacrifice, other beings who do not renounce it but surrender to their own wishes and desires and bring them to expression are able to take possession of the sacrifice and its substance and to gain the possibility of becoming independent beings alongside the other beings. Thus, with the transition from the development of the sun to the moon, and with the cherubim becoming immortal, the possibility arises for other beings to separate themselves in their own substance from the continuing development of the cherubim, indeed to separate themselves altogether from immortal beings. We also see, by discovering the deeper reason for remaining behind, that the responsibility, if we wish to speak about the ultimate factor of causation, for holding back these beings does not rest with the beings themselves. That is the most important point that we must grasp. If the cherubim had accepted the sacrifice, the luciferic beings could not have remained behind, for they would not have had the opportunity to become embodied in this sacrificial substance. Renunciation was the prerequisite for beings to become independent in this way. Wise cosmic guidance orders things so that the gods themselves called their opponents into being. If the gods had not deprived themselves, it would have been impossible for beings to oppose them. Or, to express it simply, we could say that the gods were able to foresee that if they continued to create only as they had done since the transition from Saturn to the Sun, then free beings who acted out of their own initiative would never have come into being. The gods recognized that in order for free beings to be created, the possibility had to be given for opponents to arise against them in the cosmic all, so that they could meet resistance in whatever was subject to time. They knew that if they themselves were the only ones to order everything, they would never be able to find such opposition. We can imagine the gods acknowledging that they could make it very easy for themselves if they were to accept all of the sacrifice, for then all evolution would be subject to them. But they decided not to do that. They wanted beings who were free from them, who were capable of opposing them. Therefore, the gods determined not to accept all of the sacrifice in order that beings, through the gods' own resignation, and the fact that the others themselves accept the sacrifice, might become their opponents. We see, therefore, that we must not look for the origin of evil in so-called evil beings, but in so-called good beings, who by their renunciation first made it possible for evil to arise through beings capable of bringing evil into the world. Now someone could very easily object, and I ask that you allow this thought to work very precisely within your soul. Someone could object, "Until now I had a much better opinion of the gods. I used to think that the gods were capable of setting the stage for human freedom without necessarily creating evil. How is it that all of these good gods were not able to bring human freedom into the world without evil?" I would like to remind you of the Spanish king who found the world terribly complicated and commented that if God had left the creation of the world to him, he would have made it much simpler. Human beings may think in their weakness that the world could have been made simpler, but the gods knew better, and therefore did not leave the creation of the world up to human beings. From the point of view of spiritual science, we can characterize these conditions even more exactly. Let us assume that something needs a support, and someone suggests that the necessary support, could be provided by erecting a column on which the object could then be placed. The person to whom this suggestion was addressed could then say, "But there must be another way of doing this. Yes, why shouldn't it be done in another manner?" Or someone could say, when using a triangle during construction, "Why should this triangle have only three angles? Perhaps a god could have made a triangle that did not have three angles." But it makes as much sense to say that a triangle should not have three angles as it does to say that the gods should have created freedom without the possibility of evil and suffering. Just as three corners belong to a triangle, so to freedom belongs the possibility of evil brought about through resignation on the part of spiritual beings. All that I have been speaking of belongs to the resignation of the gods. For in order to guide evil back to the good, after they had risen to the level of immortality by renouncing the sacrifice, the gods created evolution out of immortality. They did so by means of this very resignation. The gods did not avoid evil, which alone could grant the possibility of freedom. If the gods had suppressed evil, the world would be poor and unvaried. The gods had to allow evil to come into the world for the sake of freedom, and therefore they also had to acquire the strength necessary to lead evil back to the good. And this capacity is something that can come only as a consequence of renunciation and resignation. Religions always exist to portray the great cosmic mysteries in pictures and imaginations. We have referred to the ancient phases of development today, and by adding the concept of resignation to those of sacrifice and the virtue of bestowing, we have taken another step into true reality, in contrast to Maya and illusion. Religion gives us such pictures and concepts. Therefore, in biblical religion too, we can gain access to the concepts of sacrifice and the resignation or rejection of the sacrifice. For instance, there is the story of Abraham, who is going to present his own son as a sacrifice to God, and of God's foregoing the patriarch's sacrifice. If we take this concept of foregoing into our soul, then meditative images, such as we have already formulated, also come to us. Once I suggested that we assume the sacrifice of Abraham had been accepted and that Isaac was sacrificed. If God had accepted this sacrifice, the entire ancient Hebrew people, who stem from Isaac, would have been taken from the earth. By renouncing the sphere of the Hebrew people, withdrawing it from his circle of influence so that it came to be outside him, God granted as a gift all who derive from Abraham. If God had accepted Abraham's sacrifice, God would have taken into himself the whole sphere where the ancient Hebrew people were active, for the sacrificed Isaac would have been together with God. God relinquished this course, however, and thereby allowed this entire line of evolution to transpire on earth. All concepts of resignation, of sacrifice, can be awakened in us through the deeply meaningful picture of sacrifice presented by the ancient patriarch. We can find another instance of resignation or sacrifice by higher beings in earthly history. And here too we may refer to something that we already mentioned last time, namely Leonardo da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper. Imagine that scene in which we have before us, at the same time, the essential meaning of both the earth and the Christ. Let us penetrate the full meaning of the picture, and so let us recall the words we find in the Gospel, quote, "Could I not summon a whole choir of angels if I wanted to avoid the sacrifice of death?" Unquote, Matthew 26:53. End of footnote. With resignation and renunciation, Christ refuses this obvious and easy solution he could have invoked. The greatest example of renunciation that Christ Jesus brings before us occurred when he allowed his betrayer, Judas Iscariot, to enter his sphere. If we are to see in Christ Jesus what we should be able to see in him, we must see in him a reflection of those beings who had to renounce sacrifice and whose very nature is that of resignation. The Christ renounced what would have occurred if he had not allowed Judas to act as his opponent. Just as the gods themselves, during the time of the ancient sun, called forth their own opponents through their deed of renunciation. So we see this event, the coming forth of the opponents to cosmic powers, repeated pictorially on earth. We see Christ in the midst of the 12, together with Judas, who stood there as the betrayer. In order that what is of incomparable worth to humankind could enter the course of development, Christ himself had to place his opponent in opposition to himself. This picture makes a profound impression upon us, because gazing at the Last Supper reminds us of a powerful cosmic moment. Holding before us the words of Christ, quote, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me," unquote, footnote John 13:26 and Matthew 26:33, end footnote, we see the earthly reflection of the opponents of the gods set in motion to the gods by the gods themselves. I often say that everything that inhabitants of Mars would see, were they to descend to Earth, would be more or less interesting, even if they were not able to understand it fully. But by looking at this picture of Leonardo da Vinci, such Martians would discover something about a cosmic perspective that would be relevant not only to the Earth, but to Mars as well, and indeed to the entire solar system. And thereby the significance of the Earth would be recognized. What is portrayed in the Last Supper is an earthly picture. What is portrayed in the Last Supper in an earthly picture has meaning for the whole cosmos, the setting into opposition of certain powers over against the immortal divine powers, and Christ, who overcame death and demonstrated the triumph of immortality on earth and appears in the midst of his apostles, gives evidence of a significant cosmic moment that arose as the gods differentiated themselves from time-bound beings and achieved a victory over time, that is, became immortal. All this may be felt in our hearts when we look at the Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci. Please do not say that one who views the Last Supper with simple, naive sensitivity does not understand what we have said today. Such a person does not need to know these things. For the mysterious depth of the human soul is such that one does not need to know intellectually what is felt in the human soul. Does the flower know the laws by which it grows? No, but it grows in spite of that. What need has a flower for natural law? What need then has a human soul for reason, for intellect, if we are able to feel? What need then has a human soul for reason, for intellect, if we are to feel the incomparable magnitude of what is there before us, when spread out before our eyes we see a god and that god's opponent? When the loftiest that is capable of being expressed, the distinction between immortality and mortality, is brought before us. One does not need to know that intellectually. Rather, when a human being stands before this picture that mirrors the very meaning of the world, the experience penetrates the soul with magical force. Nor did the painter need to be an occultist in order to paint it. Nevertheless, powers existed in Leonardo's soul that could bring to expression precisely this highest, most significant meaning. That is why the greatest works of art have such a powerful effect. They are deeply linked with the meaning of the cosmic order. In earlier times, artists were connected to the significance of the cosmic order, in dim consciousness, without knowing it. But art would perish. It would not be able to continue, were it not that in the future, spiritual science as a new form of knowledge will bring a new foundation to the arts. Unconscious art has become a thing of the past. Art that allows itself to be inspired by spiritual science stands at the beginning of its development. Although artists in the past did not need to know what stood at the basis of their artworks, artists in the future will have to know. But they will have to know by means of powers that can once again portray immortality, powers that can present something out of the full content of the soul. For whoever tries to make spiritual science an intellectual science, expressed in schemes and paradigms, does not understand it. But whoever, with all the concepts we have developed here, such as sacrifice, bestowing virtue, and renunciation, experiences with every word what seeks to spring forth from the word, the idea itself, experiencing what flows out of the many-sided nature of the pictures, that individual understands spiritual science. One can present schemes if one believes that the development of the world fulfills itself in abstract concepts. But if one wishes to present such living concepts as sacrifice, bestowing virtue, and resignation, schemes no longer suffice. These three words can be presented schematically, if only one does not think much beyond a few letters. But if we wish to consider these concepts, sacrifice, the virtue of bestowing and renunciation, then we must paint pictures for ourselves, such as those we described the last time. The sacrificing thrones, who sent their sacrifice up to the cherubim, who spread out the smoke of sacrifice, who received the light back from the archangels, and so forth. And when in the next lecture we move forward to consider the moon existence, we shall see how the picture becomes richer. We shall see how the liquefying of the gathering cloud masses, which ripple as moon mass, and the enchanting lightning of the seraphim have to be added to it. Then we shall have to try to reach a fuller understanding. About this let me say, in the future humankind will find how to create the possibility, the artistic material, the artistic means, to bring to expression in and for the outer world what otherwise may be read in the Akashic Chronicle. The end of Lecture 3.